Hello.
What delicious beverage are you enjoying?
That was a canned Perrier.
Oh, so fancy.
You know, lately the last couple batches of Perrier that I've gotten from the Safeway have had a bit of an off taste to them. Like, I don't know, they were on the shelf too long or something. Although I know they haven't because I like clean them out every time they have them. So I don't know what it was, but this one tastes normal mostly.
It didn't have that fresh can taste?
No, it had more of a stale metal taste.
Oh.
Should I turn on the live stream for this?
Yeah, you always got to pay attention to the shelf life of your metallic water storage units.
I mean, there's not really a expiration date on a canned beverage, is there?
I mean, I know there's Best Buy flavor dates and stuff on things.
Oh, look at that. Best Buy, January 19th, 2017. I should have checked the other one. This one has two Best Buy stamps.
Well, then it's twice as best.
It's pretty good. It's pretty good.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Did I tell you about the time that I went to the grocery store and the young girl asked me if I needed a bag for my beer because she thought I was buying a case of beer and it was just Perrier, and I didn't know if I should feel old or like not old in that instance, but I just kind of grabbed my little box of Perrier and ran out and said thank you.
No, you should feel like a snob. It's Perrier.
Yeah, but the young girl who I don't even think was able to buy alcohol thought I was buying a case of beer. Just, you know. Well, cruising through the Safeway to pick up a case of beer on my way home.
To her, I'm sure it probably doesn't make a whole lot of sense that somebody would buy water in cans with fancy labels, but...
I mean, it's not that fancy. It's just, you know, it's interesting.
It's not that fancy. It's just something that people usually make jokes about how fancy it is off of.
I guess. The label has bubbles in the shape of the old school bottles, but it's on a can, which doesn't make a ton of sense.
Okay.
I also
the
have
struggle
a case,
is real.
I also have a case of the half-liter plastic bottles of Perrier sitting behind me, along with two other 40 cases of Costco water and a case of Gatorade. It's leftover craft service from the video.
Okay.
There's also a fog machine and a hazer behind me. I can turn on the fog machine for some added production value for this episode if you want.
Well, you should put the Gatorade into the fog machine so that way you're inhaling electrolytes.
No, I don't think it works that way.
Oh.
Can you huff electrolytes? Is that a thing? Can you do that?
Probably not. It's just salt.
Can you freebase an electrolyte? What do you do?
They're just salts, Stan.
Just salts?
It's got what plants crave. That's the thing. How did your shoot go?
Oh, it was fine. It occurred. It is over. It happened. It was cold. There was snow. It was cold again. A lot of things happened. It was rushed. It was good. It was hard. It was fast. Other adjectives.
Okay.
You'll have to be more specific.
Sounds like a very unsatisfying honeymoon.
No, it was great. It was in Sedona. The scenery was beautiful. The terrain was covered in snow, which was unpleasant. But it was good. It was good.
Mm-hmm. So everything went as planned.
No. I mean, mostly as planned. Our pool thing that you talked to me about, which probably nobody has any context for.
Yeah, okay. So
it didn't work.
you called me in a panic on Sunday night, asking me for advice on how to shoot a collapsing pool thing onto pavement in the snow area. Or it was complicated.
That's as good as an explanation as I suppose you could get in a couple seconds.
Yeah, I saw the setup you had there where there was like snow on either side of the thing and there was like a little strip of asphalt that it was on. And I was like, okay, I don't know what's happening.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So
we surrounded the fail area with the snow, so we did have a white backplate for it to combine it.
It was called the fail area?
The fail area on the pool, the side of the pool that was intended to fail. Fail area. Trying
it's
to
a
be
technical
brief.
Term.
Technical term. The technical term for the pool struts that had pneumatic rams in them instead of posts. But yeah, they Combination of the cold weather rendered the PVC liner quite hard and stronger, much stronger than we had anticipated. So we broke many things, and then box cutters came out, and then wire came out, and then thick ropes came out, and then eventually the water came out, but it didn't work out so well.
My apologies.
Yeah, no, that particular shot was kind of a debacle because we set it up in a different place because we got snowed out of the other location. And like right as we were about to shoot, the sun went behind the mountain, so we had to bust out the 12K light to bring the sun back. And, you know, the light was fine, but then the sun being gone, the temperature dropped like 25 degrees and it was incredibly cold, and it took about 2 hours to get the thing to try to work right. And it was a debacle, and then we got back over to the other location where the sun had still been, and we warmed up, but then the snow was melting, and then everyone was slick, and a couple of people fell and kind of bruised themselves, but we had the EMT there to help them out, so it was fine.
You had an EMT?
Are you kidding me?
I don't know.
We had an EMT. We got a guy swinging a sword around in the middle of nowhere. We've got a pool that's supposed to fall over and splash water everywhere. Yeah, we had an EMT standing there the whole time.
Okay, I don't know how guerrilla this was or how like official it was, so...
I don't think you can use the term guerrilla filmmaking once you have an LLC behind your name.
Okay, I don't know. I don't know the specifics. I'm not here to judge. All I do is I do computer stuff. You're doing practical effects. That's the superior skill set, so I can't speak to it.
Oh, man. You want to talk about practical effects. Like, there are so many things that we shot that have just been fully punted into CG shots now. So, like, there was supposed to be an additional physical element set up, but we ended up just sticking a piece of metal in the ground, and I'm going to have to roto around it and put the rest of the things back there just because we didn't have time to actually set stuff up. But it's all CG.
Oh.
CG is the way to go, man.
That's not what I heard when I was reading those think pieces during the summer that said that this was the year for practical effects.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to ruin the magic of how pools work, but CG.
Okay.
Yeah, anyway. So
Is the pool going to talk? Is it going to say Misa pool? Is that what it's going to do? Because everyone loves that.
It's like the water is going to come out like it did a spit take, and then the part's going to flap, and it's going to talk and say Misa.
Oh, it should come out like that. The pseudopod in Abyss, and then it should form Jar Jar's head, and then it should do a spit take.
That might be slightly outside the scope of our post-production budget, but I'll see what I can do.
Oh, really? It's just computers. Unless, you just push a button, right?
Unless you would like to be the one that pushes that particular button.
No, I'm not qualified to push those buttons.
But you use those fancy softwares like Katana. There's a new version of Katana out. Did you see that?
Yeah. I
didn't look at it. What does it do?
It's new. I didn't look at it either. I'm not using Katana in my job.
I have an actual Katana over here next to my desk.
Yeah, I know that.
Actually, there's two of them.
Yeah. For your set shoot thing.
It's fun.
Are you keeping that, or does that need to go back somewhere?
Oh, it's mine. The dull one was actually provided by our director of photography, Jeff Carolli, and that one he had for another shoot, and that goes back to him, but the sharp one's mine.
Oh, good.
It's funny, the EMT guy, he didn't have a whole lot to do, obviously, because we weren't hurting ourselves very much, but basically at any opportunity, he walked up and sort of tapped me on the shoulder and said, can I hang on to that for you? And just, you know, took the sword away from me.
I mean, was he playing with it, like, when you couldn't see, like, he'd go walk to the other side of the truck and just be like, whoosh, whoosh, whoosh.
No, he was not playing with it. I think he just wanted to be the one holding the large, sharp sword.
Okay.
You know, occupational hazards and all that.
Mm. Yes. Swords are dangerous. Especially if they're made out of lasers.
You know what type of sword is slightly less dangerous?
Mm.
A swordfish.
Oh, God, you're fired.
I thought you saw where that was going.
No, I thought it was too soon to go to the movie because I have so little to say about it.
Can kill some more time, but I'm just, you know.
Yeah, no.
I took the opportunity when it was there.
Oh, God.
I'm actually slightly proud of that one.
Okay, so we're going to practice catch and release.
CG to katana to sword to swordfish. There you go. That's good.
Wow. That was... What?
Set him up and knock him down.
Oh God, you did. you knocked that one down into the park.
Knocked it down with a fish.
So down into the park.
Good week. How was your week? You weren't trudging around in the snow, presumably with a sword.
No. You'd think that might be a possibility for me here in Los Angeles, but it wasn't. So I had some stuff where I went places like work, and then I, you know, went home. And so I had those things lined up for me. It was pretty exciting, I have to say. There's some other news bits had happened. There was the Oscars announcements things for nominations and stuff, and the Golden Globes and stuff that had happened on, you know, the thing with the stuff.
Yeah, I missed the Golden Globes.
I wouldn't say I missed it. And so those things happened, and, you know, we got our nominations coming up, and I've seen Mad Max Fury Road now, and I've seen...
Did you watch it on HBO?
No, I had bought it when it was on sale a couple months ago, and then I finally got around to watching it.
Oh, good. It's on HBO now, though, by the way.
I saw that when I went to do the series search to bring up my movie, and then it was like, that was an option. I was like, oh.
Way to go, chump.
Yep. Yeah, so anyway, that's there. And then
What'd you think of Fury Road?
You know, this isn't a Fury Road podcast, so I don't want to spoil it, but... I will say that for the level of hype that was attributed to it, I kind of was expecting a little more. I think that might have been everyone saying so many positive things about it.
Was it remotely in line with your expectations, or was it entirely different?
It was in line with them. It just didn't like super sail super far into the realm that it seemed to have for other people. I liked it okay, but I wouldn't call it like the best thing I'd seen this year, but it was good. It's just a car chase, a really really long one, with punctuated by different things that happen. But it's just chasing.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm.
It will probably shock you to know that I am on your side with that one.
Yeah, there's a ton of action, and it's all beautiful and amazing and neat, but at the end of the day. You can break it down really simply into what happened, and that's it. And so it didn't soar to new heights, but it was fine.
Yeah. It's commendable for its world building and all those other things that everyone talks about. You know, it doesn't handhold the audience through all the things it does well and all that.
World building? Come on. Gas Town?
Well, world building in the sense that it's not like... It doesn't have to explain itself to the audience and say, like, here are the rules. You get thrown into it, and you learn as you go, and the things... You're in a different world, and it's consistent, and it does things in those worlds, and you sort of follow along from there. It's not like... There's not a scene and a half of exposition like Swordfish, where they just sit down and just verbally say everything that's going to happen. But in terms of what it actually does, it does its thing. It does what it's set out to do. It does it well. But it doesn't really, like, I don't know, tickle the part of my brain that loves movies as much as it does other people, apparently.
Yeah, and then the other thing I'd seen that everyone had talked about but is not up for any awards is a Tangerine, which was actually very interesting. And I don't know, maybe I'm so disconnected from seeing indie films that I was actually like, wow, this is such an amazing indie film, but maybe they're all like this, and I'm just not in tune with that environment anymore. But
Was that 2015? I feel like it was nominated for something last year.
No, it was Sundance at the beginning of last year, so in January of last year.
Hmm, maybe that's what I'm thinking of, so but it was nominated for something, at least. I saw ads running, you know, saying it was... I don't know.
Yeah, it won like different festivals and stuff, but it didn't win. It wasn't nominated for Golden Globes or for Oscar, or the Academy Awards.
Fair enough.
Yeah. So it's that was interesting. Third act is a disaster. But you know, it's on Netflix. So if anybody is feeling like seeing something a little experimental and outside of their, I would assume comfort zone, then I would say that's something to watch. And it's also interesting from a technical standpoint because they shot it all on an iPhone 5S. So there's that.
Who needs more than 1080? That's all you need.
It's really, it's sort of like you're watching, like, you know, 16 millimeter film or something. Like, it doesn't have the gross VHS quality to things that, you know, VHS stuff has, or like cheap DV stuff has. Like, it feels a little more filmic than that, but it's definitely not superior.
Did they at least use something other than the default camera app? Because I assume there would just be hunting autofocus the entire time in the dark environments.
Oh, yeah. They used, what was it, Filmic Pro, which is
it's a good one.
Yeah. And they had some sort of a funky stabilized rig for that, too. And there was an anamorphic lens adapter that they used to sort of squeeze in a little bit. And they unsqueezed that later on the computer. And then they did their color mastering in, I want to say it was Dissolve, but...
Resolve?
Resolve. DaVinci Resolve.
Okay.
D's and the Zolves. Anyway.
Yeah.
You got there.
Yeah. This is the refocused podcast.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's fun.
Yeah.
And was there anything notable about the nominations you wanted to talk about?
Well, there was very briefly a VFX breakdown for The Force Awakens that the Academy put out on their YouTube account before somebody was like, oh, crap. We don't want to do that. So
they were just testing the tweet to make sure it was under 140 characters, and accidentally hit send instead of close.
Yeah, and then left it there for a few hours. And then somebody realized, no, we don't want that up on the internets, so we're going to have you take that down now. And so it was made private.
There was a surprising amount of specificity in the text on screen talking about what you should be looking at and note such and such and look over here and look at that stuff. Normally you don't see that stuff in these kind of reels.
I kind of assume that it is addressed to the audience of the Academy that will be judging it, perhaps.
Oh, the voters who have no idea what they're actually looking at?
Yeah, the peons will show up and be like, computers are ruining our films and actors and blah, 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 those people. I think that's mainly addressed at that.
None of this Star Wars can be can be computers, because the first one they made was in the 70s and we didn't have computers, so it's just another one of those.
Yeah, well, one of my favorite things was all of the marketing that they started, like, what was last spring? All of the practical effects, we believe in practical effects, blah, 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 blah. You know that whole thing that went on forever, and it just drove me bonkers. Because then people were writing think pieces based off of that marketing stuff, off of the little sound bites from JJ. Like, there was that Verge piece that was like, this is the year that we're going back to physical effects with Mad Max and The Force Awakens. And it wasn't.
No.
Totally didn't do that. You know, now seeing all this stuff, it's sort of like a vindication of that, where, you know, the VFX supervisor on Force Awakens is, you know, finally doing those interviews where he says, you know, it was 2,100 of the 2,500 shots have some sort of digital component to them. So, yeah, there's that, you bozos.
It's a lot of shots, Joseph.
Yeah, it's a bunch. But it was kind of funny. Like, the Verge wrote that up today as there's some digital augmentation that had happened, and I was like, oh, augmentation. That's a fun word. That's a great way to describe it. I don't know. You saw the VFX breakdown reel too.
I did. Yeah. There's a lot of work in there. There's even more work than I would have anticipated in a couple of those sequences.
Yeah,
but I think some of the practical effects hoopla, you know, it was touted by the filmmakers. I think a lot of it back then was also sort of perpetuated by the fans who, you know, you remember that one that JJ did where it was sort of that, like, close up interview, and then it just kept slowly backing out further and further until you could see the Millennium Falcon behind him. And I think a lot of it was just because everyone was so excited to see a Millennium Falcon that they were like, oh, look, they're making things, they're making real things, and it kind of had a longer lifespan than just going like, yeah, here's like half of a spaceship and then we'll do the rest later. But
yeah, no, people were insufferable about it, which is the only reason why I've been pointing it on Twitter nonstop. Especially, there are a few of those shots where they made such a big deal about having the Falcon set, But there's a shot in that VFX breakdown reel where it's on the ground there, and it's the one where Rey and John Boyega are running towards it, and it's not there. It's not there. Yeah, guys.
There's nothing there.
There's not a thing there.
There's like a 12x12 green screen, and then like 50 yards away, there's another 12x12 green screen. I don't even know what those were doing there. Like, they were just there to catch mats for like the little flowy cloth thing that was supposed to be over the edge of it or something. I don't know.
It was there to give paint something to do. But that was all there. It was also entertaining to me because, you know, Roger, the VFX supervisor, was saying, oh, well, a quarter of the BB-8 shots are CG, after they made such a big deal about how they built a practical puppet for it. And so that's also refreshing. So I've been having a good week going through all of these things and being like, yes, see you bozos.
Yeah, the problem is going to be what people actually remember years from now. People are going to remember that stupid hype more than they're going to remember getting their comeuppance about it around Oscar time.
Yeah, and as Sauce points out in the chat room, The Revenant, which is up for a VFX Oscar as well as Best Picture. I haven't seen it, so I don't want to poop all over it. You know, yeah. does a bear poop in the woods? But
if it's CG, no, I don't think it does.
There's been a bit about that. I know he had really downplayed for Birdman the level that VFX had contributed to it, and I believe that when we did the Birdman episode, I may have
we spent a half hour talking about how he's a horrible person for doing that.
Yeah, I may have said some unflattering things about him. I think
that is entirely accurate, and I think people would do well to listen to that episode again and kind of repurpose a lot of those thoughts to a lot of the same things that are happening here. Like, they couldn't pull a lot of those stunts for The Revenant because, look, I don't care what you're trying to hide with quote-unquote movie magic. There's no way anyone's going to believe they let a bear anywhere near Leonardo DiCaprio. That's not going to happen. So, you know, this other direction they're going with, talking about how they really did all of these brutal things out there in the cold. And the thing that gets me the most is this using natural lighting thing. Like, I've heard that touted so many times. Like, we didn't bring any lights. Like, good for you. Like, who cares? Like, that's not a good thing to say. And of course, what that means is that the people in the DI who had to color correct the damn thing had to do hundreds of thousands of hours of work to make it look like an actual movie, because you need light, and, you know,
and to make it look like it was shot during the same time of day when you're cutting back and forth.
I mean, you know, speaking from a little tiny bit of recent personal experience, you can get a lot of bounce light off the ground when it's covered in snow, which will do a lot for your exposure, and it'll let you sort of do whatever the hell you need to do and shoot sort of later into the day and still have exposure. But none of it's going to look the same, because it's just a solid white flat thing on the ground, and you all have to match it. And oh my god! But this idea that they're saying, like, yeah, you know, it's pure cinema, even though, you know, it's all shot on Alexa 65, so it's all digital stuff. And it's just like, I don't know why they pick these things to hold on to try and minimize the post production work of it. Like that takes anything away from the fact that these guys were out there buried in snow, freezing their butts off this whole time while they're making this movie. Like, that is commendable on its own. Like, why do they need to say these other ridiculous things?
Yeah, well, and it's reached a point of parody where it's more about getting an award for how hard it was to make the movie rather than the movie being any good. So everyone's like unleashing on them at this point. The Onion has Leonardo DiCaprio hopes he screamed and cried good enough in The Revenant to win an Oscar.
And, you know, I hear from people that it's actually a pretty good movie. I mean, I hear it has some issues, but it's supposed to be a pretty good movie, and I'll probably see it at some point. But, like, all of this nonsense talk from the marketing department around this movie, and, you know, still having a little bit of a sour taste in my mouth after Birdman, like, I kind of just don't really want to support these guys as filmmakers. Like, I'm sure that's kind of a mean thing to say, but like, all of this just is such a turnoff, even if the movie is good. Like, I don't know, man. I feel like I can't support them, like, on a personal level.
Yeah, well, it certainly isn't warming the cockles of my heart, so to speak. I'm not feeling like super amazingly warm towards them, and they were not at a good place from the previous film last year, but they've only gone down. So, but I don't want to rail against it without having seen it, because I feel like that would be a little hypocritical. I will just say that everything they've done to promote themselves making this movie is bad. I don't enjoy any of that.
And I think we're okay to talk about that, because that we don't need to see the movie to see that these weird hoops that they're trying to jump through to make people go see the movie. And I'm sure the movie will be a success, both critically and financially, especially if they didn't even bother using any lights, so it probably didn't cost all that much money to make.
Oh, no.
I'm kidding. They put all the money in post.
Yeah, no. Well, I mean, but it also cost them forever, because they spent all the time doing rehearsals all the time, and how hard that was, and they'd lose whole days if they didn't get the take right once they had done everything. It was just like, oh, God. You poor things. You poor crazy people. Nature's
not the most compliant when you're trying to shoot outdoor stuff. Like, you know, he kind of had it easy on an interior set with Birdman. He could just, you know, set it up and light it and make it look nice and do what he had to do. But outside, if the sun's in the wrong place, you ain't shooting.
Yeah. And snow and all that other stuff.
I gotta tell you, it makes things a little hard.
Yeah, yeah. So I've heard. Get a slice right through it.
There's nothing less fun than, like, you know, being a half hour before the sun is completely gone, and you go like, hey guys, I really need you to set this thing up in the middle of the snow, and I know you're all freezing and want to go home, but I need you to do that. Just that look they give you where, like, all right, I guess. It's like, I'm sorry. I apologize. Mm-hmm. Can I pay you more? Can I bring you some coffee? I'm sorry.
I yelled really loud in this movie when I was angry, and I started crying hard after I got upset. So hopefully the guys who choose the winners saw all that and liked it, said DiCaprio, who expressed optimism that his chances will be further bolstered by the fact that in addition to stumbling and falling a bunch of times in the snow, there were some scenes where he shouted so loud it made his throat hurt, and sometimes spittle even came out of his mouth and got trapped in the big gross beard he grew. I bet my chances are good, because this is the most I've ever screamed and cried. Way more than I did in Revolutionary Road or Gangs of New York. Plus, my nose was dripping a lot, but I didn't even wipe it. I just left it there. DiCaprio then admitted that he's still somewhat nervous, that he did a bad job during the parts where he sat quietly and looks at something far away.
See, you know, that's how you know it's period appropriate, because, you know, back then they didn't have a concept of, like, handkerchiefs, so they didn't wipe their nose.
Yes. Oh, God. Anyway, like I said, we probably shouldn't keep railing on it, because we haven't seen it, so it's
no,
little,
I we're just sort of, we're mm-hmm. just being silly now.
It's just the promotional thing about how much they want an award. Their thirstiness, if you will, that I choose to make fun of.
So you're looking forward to the award ceremony to see who wins.
I will not watch the award ceremony. When
just because it angers you too much?
Well, it is a little frustrating to sit through the whole rigmarole for this thing. Also, let's not forget that, again, this year, you know, white guys.
Yeah.
And white girls. Just white people. Just lots of white people.
At least a fair amount of people are calling him out on that, because that's a little ridiculous.
Yeah, I know, but that happens every year, so it feels a little ineffective at this point to criticize them for it, since nothing seems to change. But, you know, I'm sure all these movies about white people who have it so hard will win all these awards for them having it so hard and dealing with it, and how hard it was for them to make the thing where they had it hard, and then they'll have that and they'll go into next year and they'll try to do the same thing over again. Except, you know, oddly enough, Iñárritu is the only one who's not a white guy. And it's just like, I don't like him. It's like, please have somebody else. Anybody. Yeah.
You know, addressing these sorts of issues also forces some of these folks to address the fact that we have this billion-dollar industry built around people who play dress-up and point cameras at it and stuff, and maybe they don't like that much introspection, but should probably do something about it.
Nah, everything's fine. Speaking of things that are fine and money and...
billions and billions of dollars and computers mm-hmm. and questionable fashion choices. Remember the year 2001, Joe?
I do. It was a regular Space Odyssey.
No, it was Oh, God. Now comparing the predicted future of 2001 Space Odyssey to the actual 2001 Representative Swordfish, because I kind of feel like, you know, ridiculous plot aside, like the cultural aspects of Swordfish kind of represent 2001 pretty accurately with the terrible hair and clothing and stuff. And it's kind of depressing to put those things side by side.
It is very depressing to put those things side by side, especially if you haven't seen it recently. Because we were going through the list of things that came out on Netflix in January for the podcast, and you know, the previous week we had decided on a regular masterpiece, really, and then this week you were like, well, we really got to do Swordfish, and I was like, oh, and then you're like, really, it'll be good, and then.
Well, okay, so is it your recollection that this movie was better than it actually is? Like, because
without a doubt, this movie is better, was better in my mind than it was when I sat down to watch this again.
Okay, because like, yeah. You know, in the context of years gone by, I look back on Swordfish as going like, yeah, that was a movie that, you know, sure, it was probably dated, and it was a little silly, it was a Hollywood movie, but it wasn't like. It wasn't super campy, and it was actually kind of entertaining at points. And there are entire scenes of this movie that I actually like remember the dialogue to, because some of the quippy dialogue is kind of humorous at parts, like not like laugh out loud humorous, just like, oh, that was, you know, kind of a decent line from that character. But then watching it back now, the whole thing put together, it is a thing to behold. And in attempting to try and figure out why. It was ever accepted in any EU fashion at any point. The only thing I can come up with is that it fully commits to everything it's doing, including its ridiculous world. It commits really hard, and there's no time to breathe, let alone question anything you're seeing, because this is so absurdly fast-paced, as noted by the fact that it's only 99 minutes long.
Well, except, I will say, that there are some stretches in here where I'm just like, this is actually pretty boring. What is happening here on screen?
What parts drag for you? I can think of two.
Okay, well, the initial part where Ginger is trying to convince Stanley at his oil rig, and then also later on when he's talking to his daughter, picking her up from school and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the big one.
Yeah, it was just like, this is really
the Halle Berry trying to convince him to join the party, which is like the second scene or something. That is just exposition city. So there's the inner cutting of the phone call with the ex-wife, along with like just every line out of Halle Berry's mouth is like, gee, I didn't expect to see the number one hacker in the world doing this over here. How's your daughter that you're estranged from because you came back from jail not too long ago and you need money? It's like, holy crap, can you slow down a little bit? Because this is a lot of story here just coming out of your mouth.
Yeah, and I have to say that as, let's be perfectly frank. All of the scenes where it's the camera is just like lingering on somebody's boobs or butt, I don't care. It does nothing for me personally on any level.
This movie is fascinating in the sense that it is rated R, because I don't think they would make an R-rated version of this movie ever again.
No, because they probably lose money on this if they release something like this in this current climate, in this current market.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. But, I mean, the entire movie does sort of feel like... How would you appropriately, is it too harsh to call it like a 14-year-old's wet dream kind of movie?
Well, it's like a teenager's version of a bank heist movie where it's super cool and like very late 90s/early 2000.
It's super cool, and there's guns and money, and then she just doesn't have a shirt on at one point because, like, it's awesome and stuff. Like, the person who wrote this, they can't possibly think that the world is like this at all. And this is just like the, man, if I had my way with things, the world would be awesome like this. And they wrote a movie with that mindset.
Well, you also write the movie with the mindset of you like heist movies, because it starts with... Travolta breaking the fourth wall talking about heist movies, and it is sure. a heist movie itself. So
it starts out very meta. You know, aside from the meta aspect of it, that where he goes into his weird little metaphor there,
where he compares the movie he's in to Dog Day Afternoon.
Sure.
It's setting a high bar, I think.
Well, you could see that scene there is probably like almost verbatim what they used to sell this movie to a studio. Imagine Dog Day Afternoon, but he's just like a brutal murderer from the onset. Like, you know, no
with
negotiation.
Computers.
He just goes in and starts killing people. Well, of course there's computers because it's 2001 now. Yeah. How would Dog Day Afternoon go down if they had computers? But like, you know, once you get past all that stuff and that you sort of reveal that this is a mechanism for getting into the movie, and he grabs his little hand trigger doodad thing and like tries to leave, he actually presents himself as a rather confident and commanding character, which, you know, he erodes throughout the movie. But the opening scene does a decent job of sort of setting up where we are and what we're doing.
Okay.
Do you disagree or did I lose you?
Well, it's just... It takes me out of what they're trying to establish when I'm thinking about how much they want to keep talking about movies in the movie, in the first 5 minutes of the movie, because we don't really know anything about him yet other than he's talking about a film. We don't know exactly the circumstances or the stakes or anything involved. And then after the camera lens finishes doing whatever distracting horrible thing it's doing to the whole speech.
Tilt shift. It's a slightly off tilt shift lens the whole time.
Yeah, but they keep rotating it. It's driving me bonkers. But they do all that whole thing. They walk over to the bank and they reveal the bomb and they have the person come out and they have the whole thing, Don Cheadle and the guy yelling, and people are just yelling and people are so angry and stuff's happening. And then the person's like, no, let me back in. And then it's a dog collar, you know, blah, 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 story about dog collars. And it's like, no, this isn't the time. And then Don Cheadle is yelling some more. And then, oh no, CG explosion.
Cue the Frantic Films demo reel.
And the bearings blasting through everything, and the bearing rolling up to Hugh Jackman with his face reflected in it, and all that.
Yeah, what kind of shader would you say was on that little CG bearing?
Blin.
just straight blin?
Well, I mean, the specular was probably like some Fong shading stuff. I have no idea. They probably wrote a custom shader back in the day for that.
I don't know about that.
Yeah. It's not great. And we were just talking about like CG and practical and all that stuff. This is an example where people made some bad choices. And so,
how would you have preferred they do this?
I would have preferred they didn't. Did you really need a bullet time of them going around the explosion through all the cop cars and everything? Did that really add anything to the film experience for you?
I thought it was kind of fascinating that they did this circle dolly move that's like 50 yards wide going through the sides of buildings just to show, like, you know, how do we show that this like violent impact of this explosion everywhere without just cutting back and forth from place to place to place? Like, what if we did it as a oneer but spinning around through all these buildings looking back towards the center the whole time? Like, it's an interesting idea, I think. But
hey, remember the Matrix?
When did they do a circle dolly move like this in the Matrix?
Well, just bullet time when they would, you know, go around Keanu Reeves.
Oh, sure. Bullet, yeah, I mean...
Because, like, stuff is still happening during this explosion. It wasn't, like, completely frozen in time.
Well, that would just be silly.
Yeah, but
you can't freeze time.
No, of course not. This is impossible. Time dilation. Now, that's something you do with a black hole. So, obviously, the filmmakers got a black hole, and they put it really close to the set, but not too close. Yeah, for insurance reasons. They had an EMT standing by, just in case the black hole got a little too close to one of the actors.
Right, but not too close, but because then if they yell cut, their daughter will be the same age as they are. Sorry, I didn't mean to derail you there.
So, Gargantua is a black hole. Anyway. Blah. So the thing with the stuff that happens, this...
John Travolta is a bad guy who's robbing stuff. He's robbing a bank, and he's got hostages, and they have giant bombs taped to them, and that's basically what we learn in this opening scene. And he's very calm and collected, and he apparently has the upper hand in the situation, because he's ahead of the cops. He's smarter than they are, and he's wearing a suit with this weird shirt that like has an extra button on it that covers the top of his tie. And
all of the fashion choices for him are just bad.
yeah, he's got the long hair, and then later he's got the bleached the frosted tips of the hair. And he holds his cigars in very odd ways, and he drinks triple espressos.
Well, it's weird because
it's 2001. Remember, it's 2001.
It's like a Prince Valiant comb over. Like, I don't know how to describe it, because the front of it is just like brushed straight back, but you can like see through it. And then on the sides, it's got like that little bob where it's like cut and curled underneath. And then he's got the little goatee, like.
It's not even a soul patch. It's like a 1 millimeter wide strip of hair that runs from his lip to just the bottom of his chin.
It's so awful. Like, it just, I can't even. And then later on, there's a scene.
Just so 2001.
Well, no, I never saw anyone like this ever in 2001.
It's the hyper extension of the 2001 sort of fashion nonsense that was going on at the time.
Well, hyper extension, you need an EMT for that. So.
No, you just need to ice it and put an ace bandage on it.
But later on, he has a beret on, which is it's so weird. Just watching that whole scene, it's supposed to be so serious, and he's going to like take out this guy. And you're just watching it, you're just like, why are you wearing that funny little hat?
That was probably a reshoot, and they had already cut and frosted his hair, so they needed to cover it with something. Either that, or it's just he didn't want the helicopter wash to mess up his Prince Valiant hair, so he put the beret on.
Okay, well,
he also had like a collarless sort of button down kind of wool trench coat thing going on, and you know, the black gloves, of course.
Yeah, and then
he didn't want to get fingerprints on his own gun.
No, of course not, because that would be incriminating at the helicopter shooting site by the fly fishing place. But then we go back in time a little bit to Los Angeles International Airport.
Is it 4 days early or something?
Yeah, something like that. And then there is a European hacker guy.
Axel Torvalds. Yes. That's how you can tell he's European, because his name is Axel Torvalds.
Yeah, well, also, you know, there's Linus Torvalds of you know, Linux fame.
Sure.
Somebody saw that name.
Did Linus used to carry around his laptops in like Samsonite briefcases?
No, and I don't think he had the fur coat thing going on that this guy has.
Again, 2001.
Oh, yeah. So he is at the airport, and he, you know, is trying to get through there, and then somehow stupidly packs two passports and doesn't get through customs, and then tries to escape. And that just, well, that's even more incriminating. And then they bust him for that, and then they take him to the FBI. And then that's not going very well. And Don Cheadle comes in, and he's the law, and he lays down the law, and he just starts roughing people up and throwing people into things.
He's the no-nonsense guy who's going to get his answers no matter what.
He's the bad cop.
You know, cybercrime is a serious matter.
Yes. Yes.
Especially if you hack into the FBI carnivore program and set it back 2 years, whatever that means.
No, it doesn't mean anything.
there are so many words in this movie that don't mean anything.
Every time they talk about computers in this movie, they just like threw a bunch of crap into a hat and they just like pulled things out. And you're just like, yep, 1024 bit cipher on the firewall. Sure. Yes.
They probably ran it past somebody who just like kind of cringed and went, I guess it kind of sort of. It's like if you took English.
No, this was run past no one. Literally no one.
Well, no, it's like if you took English and then ran it through a translator to another language and then translated that language back to English, that like the kind of slightly off version of it you would get. It's kind of like that, but for technology.
Yeah, well, it just leads me to believe that it's just some person who has absolutely no background in this, who is flipping through magazines and newspaper clippings and.
Well, we know they read Wired because that there is a copy of Wired in this movie.
Yeah, and picks up stuff and then just like, oh, that's an interesting word. let's jot that down.
Mm-hmm. Encryption and bits.
Yeah.
At least they were smart enough to know that they go in, 128, 512, and 1024.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, except that bit encryption wouldn't have been a thing, and if he didn't know it and then just had to crack it because, then that's not really, like, a reason why it would have been cracked, necessarily.
Yeah, it's kind of sort of not really a thing now, even, so
no.
That's nice.
Yeah, but they have all this stuff. Every time they talk about computers, it's just the worst. And it doesn't really help because the rest of the time they're not talking about computers. It's also pretty bad. So they have all the, quippy stuff about, the Finnish guy, and he has his rights, and then he doesn't because the guy gets kicked out, and then it's like, oh, but you got a call, and he leaves, and then, the two guys that work for Travolta come in and shoot the guy through the one-sided mirror thing, and then it's just like, okay, great. That was a way to get through the beginning of this. And then we go to the oil fields in Texas, only it's La Cienega, in Los Angeles, and in some of the shots you can see the water glittering in the distance, and that is the Pacific Ocean, boys and girls, not a lake in Texas.
Maybe it's the Gulf of Mexico.
No, not really, because it's supposed to be like the middle of Texas. It didn't say something like mid Texas or something, mid East Texas or something ridiculous thing. Anyway, it's none of this makes any sense, but he has like a little trailer thing and he's like playing golf. And then she drives up in her car, and then she gets out, and she's like, Stanley, 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 let me show you how to play golf. Look at my butt.
First of all, why is he playing golf on the roof of his trailer in a towel? Is it just because there's nobody around around the oil fields where he works that he just feels the need to play golf in a towel?
Yeah, because he lives and breathes and eats oil for work. I mean, this is his life. This is who he is.
Yeah, he's an oil farmer.
Yeah, he can't use computers. He can't play solitaire or anything fun, really. So he's
you can play solitaire with like an actual deck of cards.
No, you can't, Dan. That's preposterous.
Well, I mean, you can, but like when you win, it doesn't do that thing where like the cards jump off the screen and like dance for you. So it's kind of like, what's the point if you don't get that?
Yeah, exactly. How are you supposed to do that if the cards are not bouncing around the screen when you win?
I don't know. I mean, like an animal, I guess.
Could you imagine the mess you would make on an oil field if you were just like flipping cards around? I mean, come on, Dan. Let's be real.
I mean, you don't want to get a card stuck in one of those oil derricks because then it probably won't function properly. Got to get that out and then re-lubricate it.
Yeah, that would not be aces. So they have this exchange, and then she's all like, oh, you're going to invite me in? I'm going to have a Heineken for product placement purposes. And the don't you remember?
She's saying, "You're a hacker. My boss wants to meet with you. He'll pay you. You should come with us." And he's like, "No, I don't know who you are, and I'm not allowed to touch computers. So you should go away now, so I can just go work in the oil fields and stuff." And she doesn't leave, and she tries sort of everything to convince him. There's also a fair amount of sexual innuendo, which is just there because this was written by a teenager. And then she's not getting anywhere, so she pulls the daughter card and says, how's your daughter? And he gets all frustrated and pushes her out of the trailer under the ground, and then immediately calls his daughter, because that's what you do.
Well, she didn't say your daughter. She said the name, so we didn't know who it was, whether it was a wife or, girlfriend or alive or dead or what the deal was, until the phone call went through, and then the person we came to realize that the ex-wife picked up and started talking while she's going around scrounging around pills and booze and stuff, and then we pieced together that that was Holly was the name of the girl who he had with his ex-wife, who is for some reason keeping Holly away because she's evil. I don't know.
Basically, while we're in Plot City with this scene, so he got arrested for a thing with computers and went to jail for 2 years, and he lost complete custody of his daughter to his horrible ex-wife, who is now married to a guy who makes porn.
Yeah, but it is to such a cartoonish degree that she rejects him and then also embraces this other lifestyle that she has, that it's like, well, you know, you could have given us like a sliver of something to make us feel like this was an actual human being instead of just a plot device.
What kind of woman do you think marries a man who is in the rough and tumble world of internet hacking? Maybe she was already that kind of person.
No, I don't think so. It just seems so implausible. And
she also had frosted hair. Just I'm going to point out everyone who has frosted hair in this movie.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's somebody who gets frosted hair at the very end. The full Guy Fieri. And
his
so
face gets a little torched, but his hair gets frosted.
Oh.
It's a hot and cold mix. Cold mix.
Wow, Dan. You are on fire/ice today. And so
maybe I should get the tips of my hair frosted.
That would be quite the look. If you do that for your wedding, I'll be very happy.
It's a little difficult though, because the hair is curly, so you probably have to like straighten it to do it first. I don't know.
Oh, that would be even better, Dan.
No, I don't think it would. I'm not sure that it would at all.
I know where you live now. I'm going to use the return address to send you a hair frosting kit.
Oh, that's right. You do know where I live. Well, it's all right. I know where you live, too. It's fine. It's okay.
Do you? Where do I live? No, don't say it. But
In order for me to have sent you a thing with a return address, I had to know where you live.
Well, what if that was my decoy address?
Okay. I don't recall it being a P.O. box, but sure.
Well, that's exactly why you wouldn't have known that it wasn't not a P.O. box decoy.
See, you know what they call that? They call that misdirection. Have you ever heard of Harry Houdini? I can't believe a line in this movie is actually, have you ever heard of Harry Houdini?
Have you ever heard of Harry Houdini?
What?
Well, he wasn't like today's magicians who are only interested in television ratings. He was an artist. He could make an elephant disappear in the middle of a theater filled with people. And do you know how he did that? Misdirection.
What the f*** are you talking about?
Who has not heard of Harry Houdini?
I don't know.
And who calls him Harry Houdini? Just call him Houdini. Why are we on a first name basis with Houdini? Me and my pal Harry, we were talking about misdirection the other day.
You know him. I know him. Harry Houdini. But, yeah, so, yes,
he didn't have frosted tips to my recollection.
No, he didn't. Well, maybe after he faked his own death and came back, then he did, but we don't know that for sure. But this is a little ridiculous, because then he gets off the phone with his ex-wife, who's, you know, not going to let him see his kid, and he walks out the door, and Halle Berry's still there, and she's all like, oh, this is your only way, blah, 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 don't you want to see your kid, don't you want to be a good dad?
I know you've gone to court like 5 times trying to get your daughter back, and it always gets thrown out, and we're not going to say why, because that would put plot holes in our story here, but you need some money for a lawyer, so here's $100,000 to come meet this dude. You know, she even says, like, I know everything about you. Including like where he went to school and grew up and all that stuff. Just to prove that, like, hey, I've read this script and I know everything about you, so you should come with me because that's what it says we're going to do in the next scene in the script. And here's a thing full of money, and your dog likes me better than you because I'm a pretty girl, and you can make a face at him when he gets in your truck.
God, it's just so stupid. And what really bothers me about this is, from this initial scene onwards, we are just in the world of everything that happens to Stanley's character is something outside of his control, and it's terrible, and he can't do anything else other than the best he can do, no matter what it is, and everything around him is just the worst, and he has no alternatives. And it's like, well, actually, this doesn't make any sense. So yes, he does.
He's in over his head, and he knows it. But didn't you hear good old Axel Torvalds before he died? He exists in a world beyond your world, which I don't know, is that like parallel universe? Is that like Swordfish 616 or whatever it is?
Wow, that's a deep cut for you.
I don't know what that actually means. I've just heard it on other podcasts.
It's a Marvel universe.
It's Marvel universe.
Comic Marvel universe. Okay. Anyway, I'm just surprised you pulled that one out. But That sound bite, by the way, his little line there about Travolta is used in the soundtrack version of Paul Oakenfold. It's a soundtrack thing.
Do you remember when techno was an acceptable thing to listen to?
Yes. I had the soundtrack.
Is it full of the jazz techno that's in this movie?
It's not jazz techno. That's not what it's called.
There is so much music in this movie that is basically jazz with a techno beat.
Ugh. Well, Paul Oakenfold's mainly known as, like, I don't know, a trance guy.
I know Paul Oakenfold. I don't think all of these songs are his, are they?
Well, not the rap song at the end. That one, no.
Okay.
But he was the music supervisor for this, too. Anyway, many of the things that are techno beats are him. And it was a big, highly publicized thing about this. And so I bought this on CD, and I owned it, and I played it quite a bit, and I liked it a lot. I never ripped that to my iTunes collection so that I could upload it to iCloud and have it mangle it, so I would have to rebuy it, I guess, if I wanted, but I don't really want to, so oh well.
I wonder if it's on the Apple Music. I'll give it a listen the next couple days here.
Yeah. But... This also has us, it gives us the club scene where Travolta pulls up in his ridiculous sports car.
So it's TVR, it's actually his personal vehicle, by the way.
Yeah, that's what I said, ridiculous sports car. And then he gets out and...
It's Russian.
Yes, that's what I said, ridiculous sports car. And so he gets out and he walks into the club and the music's going. And then this is very, you know... Turn of the decade club with the concrete and the bold lighting and the lights behind different things. And yeah, you know what I'm talking about. And like the girls have wigs and different colored hair and
a lot of pleather pants too. A lot of pleather pants.
Yeah. Well, pleather was big at the time. That was the style at the time.
I never put on a pair of pleather pants. I'm just going to put that out there.
Okay. Well, I didn't either. So. What, do you want a trophy?
No, I just want people to believe me when I say that.
Wait, did you put on a pair of pleather pants? Now that you said it that way. Wait, did you?
So what happens next in the movie?
No, did you? Dan, you can't Harry Houdini me now.
I can at least plead the fifth.
No, you can't.
I can.
Did you own one pair or more than one pair?
I never owned anything.
Okay, wait, gross. So you borrowed somebody's pleather pants?
Actually, now that I think about it, I did have a pair. I don't know what they were made out of. Like, as for like a Halloween costume, but that was a different thing. I dressed up as Motley Crue one Halloween, and I purchased a pair of women's vinyl pants. Anyway,
wow.
Moving on.
Okie dokie. Look for that in the show notes, listeners.
Nope.
But anyway, aside from the pants, we move on to the part where he rounds a corner and all of a sudden all the club noise goes away for no discernible reason. And we're at the buffet banquet table thing that he has inside of the club. Which has no walls on three of the sides. And they all sit down, and Hugh Jackman is there, and a Dell computer is plopped down with a weird metal scalloped.
It's nice and shiny, and it's got a little antenna to get its 3G connection in there. I don't know how it has a cell signal inside that brick building or was concrete building, but it does, apparently.
Well, was it cell or was it early Wi-Fi?
It had like just one of those little like cell phone antenna looking things on it, so I assumed it was like a cellular connection.
Okay. Well, anyway, they sit down to do this, and Travolta is all like, "Oh, you're going to break into this thing now." And he's like, "I'm not doing that. I can't touch a computer." And then there's this weird moment here where I didn't really remember this until I was watching it this time. And I still didn't remember it having seen it this way before, but when I was watching it now, I was like, wow, he's actually like forcibly being abused here. This is a little weird. So at gunpoint, he is receiving a service from somebody and has no option and has to hack within a minute or he's going to get his brains blown out. It seems a little strange. So he's hacking, and it's not working, and access denied, blah, 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 blah. And he gets through and stuff. And the gun, you know, he wasn't really going to shoot him anyway. Oh, LOL. Funny story. And then he gets out of there and goes to the bathroom to clean himself up.
Yeah. This is a scene written by a 14-year-old who said, what would be the most badass way to be forced to do, like, a hacking thing in this cool club?
Well, this is also, like, goes back to that objection that I had, that everything in this movie is about how he had no choice and he had to do it. And so, like, even, like, sexual things, it's like he had no choice and he had to do it. And it's like, well, like, why did you write it this way? It's just, like, it goes nowhere. It has no, like, nothing comes from this in the story. It's just, like, all of a sudden it just happens like this. Yeah. It's weird.
Yeah, it sort of partially illustrates the control that this powerful, mysterious John Travolta character has over all of the people he knows. But it basically is just a really uncomfortable scene somebody was aroused by when they wrote it.
Ugh.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then Halle Berry comes in and confronts him about this, and it's like, you really need to do this thing. And he's like, that was nuts out there. I'm not going to do it. And then she's like, well, I'm going to talk you into it right now. And then, oh no, people walked in. We need to pretend like we're making out.
Yeah, this part, like, they start kissing to, like, hide the fact that they were talking in the bathroom. Like, what are they going to do? They're going to walk in and see you two talking and go like, oh, hey, sorry. Like, why? Like, what was going to be the giveaway of seeing two people talking in the bathroom that they had to start kissing?
Yeah, well, and then one of the guys turns to the other guy and says, I can't with an audience. And then they turn around and leave.
I mean, that guy was kind of funny, and then he was on his way out. But then, like, really the only reason this is here is because Halle Berry then does a delightful summary of the plot for us. You're broke. You need our help. You need our money. Think of your daughter. $100,000 is nothing. You need all of this money or whatever or something. You can't go back to oil. Think of your daughter. Think of your daughter. Think of your daughter. And it's like, oh, Jesus. Thank you for the summary again.
Well, it's also weird because, you know, she had just made out with him, and he had just received some services in the other room. So it's just like, well, why is it phrased as think of your daughter in this? Like, he's not like a saint, and he's not like, but for some reason it's like, well, we're supposed to feel really bad for him and that he's
trying
as hard as
he can. I have no choice. All of these beautiful women are like doing things to me, and there's nothing I can do about it except make $10 million by hacking.
Yeah, it's like he's supposed to stay pure through this whole thing somehow. It's like all these. It's like he keeps tripping and falling over onto the beautiful women that keep kissing him and stuff. And it's just like,
this is just the rough and tumble, like, life in the fast lane world that he lives in of computer hackers who drink wine and listen to techno.
This is really, this is a bad movie. And so they get out of here. We get some more stuff that happens. Don Cheadle, etc., and there's more, I guess, exposition with him when he gets to Travolta's place, and it's like they need a worm, but it's a Hydra, and...
Oh, wait, can we pause now to talk about all of the computer interfaces? So there's the one in the Dell where he's hacking the Department of Defense database, which is basically just like them scrolling through a Unix file system, and then there's some, not even binary, just like 10-digit numbers, and then like some fake code. There's not even really any code. There's just a lot of like access denied, access granted stuff. And then there's the FBI sort of control room where they're like noticing who came in and out of LAX airport, and they are like doing the zoom enhanced thing, but like none of it is from a high angle. It's all like from the camera that actually shot that scene earlier, so it looks really weird that the screen is like zooming into this weird low angle. And then there's the 7 monitor computer screen thing that has its own encryption that has to be hacked before you can use it. And you know, he can connect to 7 different networks all at the same time and stuff, because apparently that sounds impressive or difficult or something.
It is so stupid. It really is just mind-boggling how this is supposed to be impressive. For the
how many networks can you connect to at the same time, Joe? Like did you get the upgrade so you can connect to more than one network at the same time?
The internet. Internet. All of the networks.
Well, which internet are you connected to? Can you get to all of them?
WW2.
You got primary net, and then you've got like sub dark net, and then you've got, you know, oakenfold.net.
Yeah, well, I'm on the Gopher darknet, so I have that going for me. And then afterwards, I'm going to get on the gray market at Usenet and use the back door to firewall myself from the eBay purchases from the hackers on the Silk Road.
I know it's jumping ahead, but the scene where he actually writes the Hydra is somehow the most ridiculous scene in this entire movie, where he's like fighting the code, like he's going to battle with the code, like yelling at it. He's like, no, don't do that thing that I just did. And he's like, I like undid the work I was doing. And then he like has another drink and he like sneaks up on it and attacks it. And first of all, he doesn't know how to type at all. But like, it's all like, there's like this purple glowy light on him and it's all super cool. And he's got the music and he's like dancing and like celebrating every time he like adds an extra blob to his Hydra, like an extra worm head to his Hydra. And you know, he's drinking his wine and he's dancing and gyrating because he's excited.
He says return when he hits the return key.
He's also standing and typing fast, like he's like racing or something. It looks more like he's playing Mario Kart than anything.
Yes, it does look like it does seem more video game centric than it does seem like any sort of actual code writing.
And there's this the delightful visual interface, presumably for the stupid audience to see this like weird wireframe cube that has other cubes on it, so you can tell that he's adding bits and pieces to the thing, and then they all collapse and it becomes the Hydra, and then he's just got to modify the code and he's done.
Yeah, well, I mean, he had what was it called, like the worm tool generator,
and it right back when he was in college, he wrote the source code for the worm he's been using for all these years, and then he hid it somewhere in a tape reel drive in the basement of his college where no one would find it. So he lives in a world where hard drives or floppy disks don't exist because he can't keep his worm in his house, or this is his version of like a Backblaze offsite backup or something, but he doesn't have a copy of his software. He has to hide it.
Would you say it's a world beyond your world?
It's a world where, I guess, local storage doesn't exist or something, except for the floppy disk later.
How are you supposed to have local storage if you have to put it in your pleather pants pocket?
Yeah, that is a legitimate point, and they didn't like, have thumb drives.
How do you put your worm in your pleather pants?
I'm going to humor you and keep going with the joke. See, you would probably put the floppy disk in like your front or back pocket, but then like as you would walk, it would like bend and crack, and that would not be good, and you couldn't do a CD because they weren't very bendy either. So you would have to put it on a thumb drive, but thumb drives weren't really a thing then. Or you could put it on a zip disk, which is very strong, but that would just be really uncomfortable in the pocket of your pants if you could even get it in there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
worms in your pocket.
Mm-hmm. Right in the pants.
It's a multi-headed worm in your pocket.
Uh-huh. This is so stupid. This movie is so, so dumb. There's the whole, like, chase scene that happens when he picks up his daughter at that one point. And, like, honestly, my eyes just, like, glazed over by this point in the movie where we're supposed to care about this daughter. And I can't muster any care. There's no care to be mustered. It is unmusterable.
Yeah, after he writes his Hydra, he wants to go visit his daughter because he's in Los Angeles and his daughter lives in Los Angeles and he wants to go see her because he misses her so much. And he picks her up from school because the mom is passed out drunk because she's a horrible person. So he gives her a ride home and then they hug and he found a way for them to be together and he's going to do whatever he can to be with his goofy little artsy daughter who has strange sunglasses or something, and you can tell she's very artsy and intelligent because she's kind of different and odd, and everyone in this movie has weird sunglasses, including the daughter. But then as soon as she goes inside, he tears up a little bit, an FBI agent gets in his car and he elbows him in the face and then crashes his car into the other cop car and he runs away because I guess he thinks like if the FBI doesn't physically grab him, they will, like, not come after him because, I don't know, they don't know who he is, but they totally do know who he is. So they
shout,
like,
his name at him.
They could just, like, even if he got away, they could just go, like, show up at his place of residence and be like, hey, why did you do those things yesterday? That was not good. You're coming with us now.
Yeah, this isn't tag. So he jumps over.
It's red light, green light.
Yeah.
If I'm out of your view, you can't get me.
It's so stupid. There's this horrible shot of him looking down at the cliff water area. That's not super great. And then he jumps over it and then tumbles for an eternity. And Don Cheadle and the other agent go after him, and they all tumble for an eternity. And then they finally get down to the beach, and the cop car that Don Cheadle had sent away to go around back or something is down at the beach. And where is the service road for that to go down 1,000 feet like that? But he shows up there, and then hits him with the car, and they grab him, and they got him. Hugh Jackman's all like, F you guy, blah blah, you don't know anything, and you know, you can't bust me for stuff, and he's like, for breaking parole or evading officers and blah 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 blah. He's like, no, chill, we just want to interrogate you about things. So, you know,
yeah, reiteration of plot elements with regards to the fact that he is not allowed to see his daughter because he has a restraining order or something, because he's a deadly hacker and he shouldn't be around kids, even though he's not a bad person.
Yeah, well, being a hacker is contagious.
Sure. It'll contaminate your children and get them addicted to technology and stuff.
Yeah, it's a communicable disease.
This movie's a communicable disease.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, we also, you know, we already know that Axel Torvald is dead, but now Hugh Jackman knows that Axel Torvald is dead, and then the cop gives him a business card and basically says, like, look, man, I know you're over your head here and you kind of don't have an option, even though I'm the police and I should just, like, do my job and enforce the law and stuff. I'm going to let you go.
Not even the police, the feds.
He's the fed, right. He's the former head of the largest cyber criminal task force, but he burned out because he shot somebody in the hand, which, you know, apparently he kept his job at the FBI after shooting someone in the hand.
And then also manhandling a guy and his lawyer and getting both of them shot and killed inside of the interrogation room of his.
They probably erased that part of the tape where he was manhandling the guy because the guy got shot, so it's not like he's really going to press charges or anything.
No, he's not going to press charges, but you'd think there'd be like some paperwork for that.
Assistant Director Joy, his boss, is kind of a hot-headed jerk too, so
he's a bit of a killjoy.
Presuming that the woman that exploded in the opening scene's name was Joy, yeah, he's a killjoy because that was his fault.
But anyway, so they have this exchange, and then Hugh Jackman goes back to John Travolta's place, and there are the photos, and the photos go off to the FBI, and the senator guy gets them. But Hugh Jackman is, you know, talking to John Travolta and Halle Berry, and first he walks in on Halle Berry, who's like got a wire on and she's just naked for reasons.
Yeah, he comes home from all of that and goes directly to Halle Berry's room and just sort of walks in without knocking, which, you know, learn some manners even if you're a hacker, I guess. And she's in her underwear and got a wire on, and there's a prolonged scene where it's unnecessarily emotional for some reason. She points a gun at him and says she's with the DEA, but, you know, we're here for Travolta, so do the hack and get out of town, and then don't worry about it, bro. And then Travolta comes in the room.
Yep. And she tries to act like it's not at all suspicious, but it is. But it's not, because it isn't supposed to be. It's misdirection, Harry Houdini. And so they...
they had to know that he would come into the room unannounced at that exact moment.
I know that you know that... No, but that's ridiculous. And they go through the whole thing. And then he's like, okay, I got the thing, blah, blah, blah. And then John Travolta's like, yeah, I want to talk to you about stuff, but we can't do it here. We got to do it on a drive. And thus initiates the dumbest car chase that is in this film, where they just drive around downtown Los Angeles. It looks like Broadway and something. And then shoot at SUVs and they flip over into a diner and things explode. It's just really stupid. There's that part where John Travolta is standing up, shooting to either side of him with his arms in basically bind pose, in like a Christ pose, shooting off to the left and the right, not looking. So, you know, that's how you shoot people. And it's just like a mess of a scene. Like even in terms of execution, it's just the geography of it doesn't make any sense. Like how anyone is shot doesn't make any sense. Like where the line of action is just a total mess. So I don't approve of that.
Well, John Travolta gets to be a badass with a machine gun and shoot up a bunch of black SUVs that burst into flames and flip over. There was also, I think that scene was actually slightly later. There was also the scene where they go to the coffee shop and he explains what Operation Swordfish was, where this movie gets its stupid name.
Oh, you're right. And that's the same coffee shop that they use at the beginning of the movie slash end of the movie.
They go get their triple espressos, and it's like, oh, look at that. We're buddies. We both get the same coffee drink. That's hilarious. So two of those, please. And there's some hand-wavy nonsense about what? It's like there was a program in the 90s that had these fake companies run by the FBI, and the companies, blah, blah, somehow ended up making some money instead of being shell companies, whatever they were. So they shut down the companies but left the money there, and the money earned interest from just sitting there. So now with this $9.5 billion just sitting there waiting to be taken. But they gotta find a bank on the backbone of the network to access the secure cluster. And he's like, look behind you, there's the bank. And it's like, dun dun dun.
Yeah, well, it's also absolutely ridiculous because they're except, you know, I guess Skip Woods, the writer for this film, was like, you know, I guess I can't use the plot from Superman 3 for the bank stuff, so I'll just write this other ridiculous thing. But
I mean, because, so you know, the government has to have billions of dollars just laying around in bank accounts that somebody forgot about, because the government is just so dumb that they would have billions of dollars just sitting there unused because they screwed up and they didn't know what to do with it, right?
Yes,
it's
exactly.
Believable.
Mm-hmm. Government waste.
Yeah.
But, government. I'm sure whatever pleather pants company that they had that turned a profit and then got shut down, probably had tons of interest by that point.
Yeah, I mean, they shut it down at the height of the market, and they just, you know, they're living off the interest, because can't, you know, the pleather pants market isn't going to go up forever.
No, peak pleather.
Peak pleather, for sure.
Yeah, and so they do all this stuff, and there's the chase, and blah, 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 blah. And then they wind up back at his place, and he's like, you got to tell me. And he's like, okay, I'm going to walk you into the super secret workshop room that is here for some reason. And everyone's there welding things. it's so absurd. Then it just all spirals out of control very quickly into things just happening in order for the end of the movie to catch up to where the beginning of the movie was. Like I
like the part where, like, at the very beginning of that scene where he sees, like, it's like an abandoned, like, theater or something that they go into where they have all of the guns and stuff. But, like, he walks in and goes, like, here's the floppy disk with your Hydra on it. And John Travolta hands him a cell phone where somebody goes, like, is this Stanley Jobson? You have $100 million now, or $10 million now. Yeah. He's like, cool, thanks. Like, I'm going to chalk that up to the fact that the writer was looking for the fastest way from A to B to C, because this movie is so fast. They're like, well, we got to confirm all this stuff. It's just like, you know, we'll have a phone. It'll be like, here you go. You have your money now. He's like, cool, thanks, I guess. Like, could have just been somebody lying to him, but he believes it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's over a phone. Who would lie over a phone? Phone calls are expensive in 2001, Dan.
Especially, like, I love the part where his daughter, when was waiting for the mom earlier, pulled out her gigantic Nokia and called 411 to get the number for yellow cab.
Yeah. Anyway, so Hugh Jackman's all like, F this, I don't want you to do bad things with the stuff, because I thought what I was doing would not be used for bad things at all. And
you're not going in over the phone lines, you're going in for real, and you're doing like a real war with guns and stuff, and I'm out, bro. And then he sprints out the door and goes straight to his daughter, well, his ex-wife's house, where he finds that porn man and his ex-wife have both been murdered, and his daughter had been kidnapped, as noted by the fact that her funky little glasses are on the ground and kind of twisted up and mangled.
Yeah. And also before that, we had John Travolta give his exposition about how he has an anti-terrorist plan, you know, and this is June of 2001.
He's a terrorist's terrorist because he attacks everybody else to make them more scared of him or something, right? That's the basic premise. He runs a secret organization that was started by J. Edgar Hoover that his entire job is to do such unspeakable acts that no one would bother fight back.
Yeah. So, well, he's part of Black Cell, which is obviously totally a name that J. Edgar Hoover would come up with in the 30s. So Black Cell and all of that is all about busting up on other people. And his plan is that he will strike back at the terrorists so hard that they'll wish they never struck at people. And so, you know, they'll blow up something even more. Like one of the examples he gives is that, they do something to an embassy and they'll use a tactical nuke on, a village. What do you use a tactical nuke on? Like, other than a bunch of people, that doesn't make any sense. So he's not a good person with his heart in the right place.
This is what it takes to maintain the United States' way of life.
Yes, and you and the other 200 million Americans, this is all for you. So anyway.
Completely unchecked, unbalanced violence against random nations at his discretion.
Not even nations, just people, just whatever he feels like. Yeah. So it's an interesting policy, to say the least.
It's again, written by a 14-year-old bully who's like, hey man, the only way I can prevent other people from hitting me is to hit everyone as hard as I can so they never want to hit me.
You can do that with money and explosives. Yeah, America. So
this whole movie is just a playground full of children.
This is ridiculous. And then so we very quickly wind up back at the beginning of the movie, and we have the whole exchange occur very quickly now, where they quickly bring us back up to the point where the explosion had happened, and
he drives his Hummer straight into the bank and, like, crashes it into the guy's desk and almost plows the guy into the wall and then gets the secret key to unlock the glass door to the server from him, because apparently he needs that. He can't just, you know, go into the server room.
Well, you don't know that it was glass, Dan. It could have been Gorilla Glass. How is he supposed to drop it on an angle? You know, it's inside the wall.
They had guns.
Anyway, I also agree that it's a little ridiculous that the security for this, I guess, node of the network that they needed to do things to seems rather lax.
I mean, it's the bank manager has a key in his pocket.
Yeah,
but you know, he does a really good job of denying the key's existence, and that's really where the primary security comes from.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think if you ask most security experts, they'll say number one is deny that you even have a password, and then number two, you should probably have a slightly secure password.
Yeah, like when somebody comes after me and they're like, give me access to your bank account, I'll be like, I don't have a bank account, and then they hit me really hard and they'll be like, okay, here you go.
It's like when somebody has to borrow $10, you're like, sorry man, I don't have any cash.
Yeah,
it's exactly the same methodology of security.
Yeah, well, I mean, sometimes I don't have any cash these days. I literally never carry
cash.
Oh, yeah. How's Chip the card thing working out for you?
Oh, the coin?
Yeah.
I don't use it very often.
Oh.
I mean, I think I only ever use it when I go to Costco, because I always get to Costco and then fill a cart and I go, oh yeah, they only take Amex here. And then I pull out my coin and I'm like, well, here we go. And I cross my fingers and I slide it really slowly and I'm like, woof, it worked.
Is it hard to slide it when your fingers are crossed, or do you use your other hand for that?
I use my other hand. I have two hands. Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with fingers and hands?
I am, but could you describe the strategy here? Like, paint a picture. Like, is it your left hand that you're swiping with, or
sure,
your
okay,
right
so
hand?
Sure, okay, so here's how it goes. I walk up, and then they start scanning the items, and then I get a cold sweat because I'm like, oh crap, I forgot my Amex card. So I pull my wallet out of my front right pocket and put it in my left hand, and then I reach into the inside pocket where I keep the coin, and then I pull the coin out with my right hand, and I push the button with my right thumb, and then while holding my wallet in the left hand, still not putting it down, I reach down to my left front pocket and hit the power button on my phone while it it's still in my pocket, so it wakes up and the Bluetooth will connect to the coin and it'll go, you know, it'll unlock itself. And then once it's unlocked, I very slowly swipe it on the Costco card swipe thingy-mabob, and then it beeps and it says, like, you know, swiped waiting on cashier, and then I go, whew, and then I wipe the sweat from my brow, and then I put the coin back in the wallet, which is still in my left hand, and then that wallet goes back into my front right pocket.
Well, you know, maybe you wouldn't have so many issues with, like, sweating if you didn't wear puffer pants. It's not good for heat, you know? It traps it in.
Don't I know it. They do not breathe well.
When do you go to Costco? You gotta wear something that can breathe.
You know, it helps. It helps. Although, if you do ever overheat, you could just go back to the produce section. It's very cold in there.
Okay. You buy a lot of produce, do you, Dan?
No. I bought like a dozen apples for craft service for the shoot, and I think maybe somebody ate one.
You know,
I got a lot of leftover apples if you want an apple.
No, that's fine. Apples, you know, sometimes you see people who put out like well-meaning snacks where it's like, here's apples and here's like baby carrots. And I just look at it and I'm just like, I'm not eating that. And it's not that I want to eat like horribly unhealthy things, but like you bite into an apple, it gets all over your face. It gets, you know, sticky stuff on your hands. I mean, what are you going to do?
You just grab a handful of snow and like wash it off or something. But I also have a bunch.
Oh, I'm sorry, I forgot that my handful of snow is off to the left here.
Sure. I mean, it's all around you. I could send you some if you need a refill. I've also got a bunch of fruit snacks, a lot of granola bars. Let's see what else did I buy? I just think we had breakfast and lunch on set, so I don't think people were actually very hungry. So I have a lot of leftover snacks.
Okay, well that's great. What you want to have while you're working towards your wedding day is to have a bunch of snacks on hand.
Yeah, for sure. So here's what you do. People in the audience, send a self-addressed stamped envelope to me, and I will fill it with fruit snacks and granola bars and a bag of chips and mail it right back to you.
How many stamps would that need?
You might need maybe like a shoebox-sized package. So I don't know, what, like three?
This plan is not a good plan, Dan.
I want to get rid of some of this stuff.
What are they supposed to do? Send you a flat rate box with a flat rate box inside of it?
It's a solid plan. Can you prepay a flat rate box?
I don't think that's how that works.
My alternative is setting up like a lemonade stand style thing out on the street and just like, you know, 5 cents for a bag of chips and handing them out to people.
Okay.
Although I think that would get complicated around tax time because I don't think I could really get receipts for that kind of stuff.
No, you should bring it to the wedding and just put it out before the
ceremony. Oh, party favors, exactly. Yeah. Everyone gets a bag of Welch's fruit snacks.
Yeah,
that's your party favor.
I have gone to weddings where there's a little bag of pretzels that they put inside of every single one of the little the goodie bags, and it's just like, does anyone eat these? Like,
so there are varying opinions on edible party favors for weddings. And I think we lean on the side of non-edible wedding favors, but that's a conversation for another time.
Oh, okay. So speaking of glorious events, the end of this film features Hugh Jackman deploying the thing that divides the bank account money into the things, and they get separated, and you see all the stuff on the screen, and he gives, you know, the kid back to him, and he walks out.
Yeah. You glossed over my favorite character in this movie. The guy standing next to him running the computer, who John Travolta looks at and goes, "Verify this." And the guy looks at it and goes, "It's good." Gives him a thumbs up. And then he starts to leave, and then all of the funds disappear because he put in a back door or whatever. And then he, like, you know, fights the guy, and then his daughter runs outside and gets rescued. And then he's like, you know, "Do it again. Give me my money," or whatever. And he does the thing where he's like, "I'm thinking about your deal because you're in control." He's like, "You'll never get any of the money without me." He's like, "Do you have a deal?" He's like, "No." And then he hangs up Halle Berry. He's like, "Do it before she dies." And apparently he's such a nice guy that he can't let this person who's kind of like ruining his life that he's known for the past 2 days die. So he goes and hacks and gets the $9 billion back. And then again, John Travolta looks to verify this guy, and verify this guy goes, "It's good." Like, why would you take his word for it the second time? You didn't know the first time.
Well, you missed my favorite line. The accounts are encrypted with a 1,024-bit cipher. Even I can't break through the firewall.
Yeah, so, they jump from account to account every 6 hours or something. So yeah, not only
for the next 10 years,
not only has the government left $9 billion in this account to protect it, the bank account changes its own number every 6 hours. Why would that ever be more safe ever? Because it's still just like money in a bank account.
The government didn't do that. Hugh Jackman's thing that he transferred the money into after.
Oh, is that so?
Yeah. Like, that was his plan to get back at John Travolta, because that was how they were going to get around this.
So he wrote the 1024-bit encryption that he can't break.
Yes. That's what he was getting at. And then John Travolta challenges him to do it because he's got Ginger on the strangly cord thing up there, and she's all gasping for air and stuff, and this means that he really needs to, because otherwise she will die. So that means he does, which doesn't make a lick of logical sense at all, because that's sort of just like, I guess, the same logic as you need to lift a car, otherwise this person dies, and it's like, sure, I'll lift the car. I don't understand like where this comes from at all. It doesn't make any sense. So he does this thing where, under this time crunch where he had previously said this thing was impossible, he manages to get all the money back. Then
put in a back Ginger, door, and he sure did.
Yeah, and then Ginger comes down, and John Travolta shoots her, and she falls over on the ground, seemingly dead. They all leave rather unceremoniously. All of the people walk onto the bus.
Don't feel bad that we shot her, though, because she was DEA, and I knew she was DEA, so, you know.
Yes.
It's all right.
Wink. They all get on the bus, and they drive off, and then they're on some bridge, and then they turn around, and they go back down the other way.
Don't forget Vinnie Jones.
Yeah.
We've got Vinnie Jones of famous British movie fame in the back there.
Isn't
delicately.
He like a rugby player or something?
I think he was long ago, but he's delicately putting a rocket launcher in a box while people stare at him, including Hugh Jackman, who has a weird look on his face, and then some other guy, and he has this super clever line about sticking a rocket up somebody's butt if they eyeball him again. Just making sure it's very clear that everyone knows that there's a rocket launcher on this bus.
Yes.
Did you notice that there's a rocket launcher on this bus?
Could you say that off mic again? Because I don't think the person off mic heard you.
I was talking to everybody on this bus. There is a rocket launcher on this bus. And don't touch it. Don't eyeball me.
Mm-hmm. So silly. So they do this thing where they drive off down the bridge and then back again, and then it's misdirection, Stan. We're not going to the airport. And then the helicopter comes down and quickly, very quickly, latches onto this bus and pulls it up through downtown. And they crash through a sign. And then they fly past a marketing session thing with the campaign.
Yes, this very talented helicopter pilot that they hired, who can fly directly over the bus while they latch on, apparently is unfamiliar with how long the cable actually is, and starts smashing into things.
Yeah, well, that's for dramatic reasons, not for any logical one.
Yeah. Although it was kind of neat, like, you know, where they lose the back to cables, and then the bus is like dangling, and like one of the people with the explosive packs goes flying out the back window, and it explodes midair and blows up the building. It's like, okay, that's kind of a cool action scene thing.
Yeah, well, and then they finally land on the thing, and the people get out, and there's another helicopter, and Travolta and friends migrate onto that. And he's still like, goodbye, Stan. Great seeing you, Stan. I'm going to leave you here with this rocket launcher now. you be good. And then he leaves on the helicopter, and the FBI are, well, they got to the building really fast, let's be honest. And they get all the way up to the top. And then Hugh Jackman's like, you know what? I know how to fire rocket launchers now because I'm a hacker. And he fires the rocket launcher and hits the helicopter, and it explodes, murdering everyone.
Because it's not going to end like this, man. It's all right. Not everything has to end the way you think it's going to end. And audiences love happy endings. Remember that callback from the beginning of the movie? We were talking about movies. Audiences love a happy ending.
Oh God, it's so miserable. When they did the meta thing again, it was just like, just kill me. I know where you're going with this. He's not going to die. Just stop it.
By the way, helicopters as a getaway vehicle. Not a great idea. You just got like guy in the radar tower at the FAA going like, there they go. They're going like 30 miles an hour that way. Just follow them until they land, because they've got like 2 hours of gas and then they got to land.
Well, you could fly under the radar deck. But, you know, I guess
under,
just,
the, under the hard deck doesn't count, man.
I guess you're just not a huge fan of helicopters. But the
you get some props for that joke.
Okay, well, let's stabilize this conversation vertically, and then so they have the thing explode, and then they identify the body, and it looks like a dead body of John Travolta, which we definitely haven't seen prior to this in the film. We did,
and the teeth match perfectly with an Israeli Mossad agent named Gabriel Scheer.
Mm-hmm.
So that, and then, you know, this being, again, we have to do everything as condensed as possible, make sure this movie moves as quickly as possible. Somebody comes into the coroner's office to tell Don Cheadle that there is nobody named Ginger at the DEA, never has been, never will be. And then we get a delight. In case you forgot, we get some nice audio flashbacks about misdirection and all those things that he said that were kind of like hints. And you know, Hugh Jackman looks at the dead body and goes, "You son of a bitch, you did it, didn't you? You got away." And then, you know, "I'm not going to tell nobody. I'm going to sneak out of here because, you know, you got away and I got away and we're all good now. So I'm not going to tell the world that there's still this crazy terrorist out there."
It's stupid. And then we go to France or whatever, and she's getting the money out of the accounts.
No, we got the diner with the daughter first.
Oh, right. The diner with the daughter in the desert area.
Yeah, they got an RV, and they're cruising across the United States going to see stuff, because apparently his daughter doesn't need like school or anything. They're just going to drive around and go look at stuff because, you know, bonding and stuff.
I can only feel like this is written by somebody who was recently through a divorce, who didn't really like his ex-wife and didn't actually understand how to take care of children, because this is not a real feasible thing you would do with a child.
He let her decide where they were going to go and what they were going to see.
Yeah, and obviously, since he has all the money, which the police would never have confiscated from him, he is able to buy the appropriate family attorney for all of these things to make sure that he maintains custody.
Well, he doesn't even need an attorney because his ex-wife's dead.
Well, that doesn't mean he gets custody. I mean, you know, she might be a foster kid. Like, how is he judged a fit parent after the events of this film?
Well, he can hire... He doesn't even need a good lawyer. He just needs a lawyer because, like, who else is... Like, they don't have the crazy porn money to hire the crazy lawyer to fight against him.
Crazy porn money. Okay. fair point. I had not considered that. So
his public defender can do a job because he's a decent guy. The FBI said they could help him out with his daughter if he helps out with their thing. So maybe the FBI hooked him up a little bit.
it doesn't make a sense. But, but
speaking of not making a lick of sense, you mentioned it briefly, but we totally glossed over the fact that that there was that scene earlier that after he was making his hydra that he went to go find a bottle of wine and he saw a dead body in the freezer in the basement of John Travolta's house that looked just like John Travolta.
Yes, and then he doesn't mention that to anyone, but then when we see the dead body later, we know that's exactly what it was for.
So if you wanted to get a dead body that looks just like you that had your same dental records, where would that come from? And would you bother explaining that? Or should we just like assume that you just, you know, you're part of this dark underworld and you just like bought a duplicate of yourself on the Silk Road or something?
Well, obviously that was Nicolas Cage.
Oh, you know, that makes sense. That really makes sense. Because this director worked on a bunch of Nicolas Cage movies after this.
Yeah, well, you know, Face Off.
No, he didn't do that one.
No, but John Travolta was in it.
Sure.
That's where you hire a spare John Travolta.
You know, he did say in this movie he's changed his appearance and identity so many times he doesn't even know who he is anymore. So maybe he really is Nicolas Cage in a John Travolta body, and the original John Travolta is dead and in the freezer.
Yeah.
Although, you know, it's probably really annoying to him that he can't cut his hair until they, like, do this whole gag, because his hair has to match the hair of the dead body, and of course, the dead body's hair isn't going to change. So he's just got to keep that stupid look all the way up until they finish this plot, and then he can go change it.
Yeah, what a burden. So he gets a also stupid haircut when they go to France or wherever. It looks like, I don't know, Nice or something. I have no idea what's going on. Somewhere in the French Riviera-ish kind of area. And she goes to the bank, and it's supposed to be like the audience doesn't possibly know who this is because it's shot from the back, and it's not her hair. It's not the hair of anyone we've seen in the film. Who could it possibly be? And it's like, well, it's not really like a mystery.
Yeah, her,
like,
her hair's straight, and she's got some funky red sunglasses on because everyone's got to have funky sunglasses in this movie. But I love this bank scene because the bank teller is like, okay, give me your account number and your password. Like, that's not how bank accounts work. Well, the password is Swordfish because, huh? Call back to the Swordfish.
Yeah, and then they do the whole thing. She gets out of there with the stuff, gets on the boat, and then...
she says, it's done to Travolta. Like, yeah. Okay.
And he's got why are you
going to speak in code?
His Guy Fieri look going on. The spike across the tips. And then we have them going off into the boat out of the harbor, and they're on the water. And then we cut to video-y footage of them doing that. And then there's a news announcement of some terrorist who was suspected in some such and such bombing of a thing, who is found dead on an exploded yacht in the Mediterranean, and then boom. So there's that. And then we go to music and credits. So the end.
It's interesting that they decided to end this movie with the news footage exposition rather than start that way, like many other movies have done.
Well, a lot of films end with news exposition when they want to say, like, and then they went on to do such and such a thing, which is what they wanted all along. Mm-hmm. And it was...
Senator John Blutarski.
Yeah. Blah. This movie sucks.
R-rated movie about hacking and guns and cars and women and blah. This movie is just such a 2001 bro kind of movie.
It's really terrible. I really hate it. I can't believe I watched this. I would like to read you some lines off of the movie poster. Log on, period. Hack in, period. Go anywhere, period. Steal everything, period.
Yeah, it's trying to put forward this idea that the smart guys who can hack stuff can get all of the money and everything else that they want because they can just they can do things that other people can't because they just have these sort of, it's like the new mafia kind of thing. It's this weird dark world that you can't even see into and we can't even explain because you're not in it, man. But you know, these guys are the new badasses of the world, and you don't even know they exist. The world is so mysterious and crazy, you have no conception of the world they live in.
Yeah, it tries to go for that, but at the same time, it's also like the actual hacker is a pure saintly figure who is a nice guy, and doesn't want to go back to jail and wants to look out for his daughter, and nobody cares about this situation as much as he does, and like everything's just about this for him, and it doesn't work. It just fundamentally, and the plot twists are all ridiculous. And
it may have kind of sort of worked in 2001 when people were not technologically savvy and didn't really scrutinize this kind of stuff as much, but this movie does not make a lick of sense anymore. And the only thing that holds up is, like I said in the beginning of this, they commit so hard to all of these stupid things they're doing and saying that you can't help but like keep watching and like let them do the thing that they're doing because they're fully committed to it and they're doing it without any sort of hedging.
I would rather watch Hackers than watch this.
Well, Hackers is like has some fun and humor to it. Although Hackers also has that like sort of random off-putting sex dream thing, which is just in there because like somebody thought it needed to be in there.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Meh. So anyway, we're sorry, everyone. Please don't watch this.
I apologize for all of 2001.
it's a big apology. So
the early 2000s were not good.
Nope. But let's move on past that. And so, ta-da, we're done.
Hmm. Swordfish.
I hear it's a meteor fish. Kind of like steak.
I'm trying to remember last time I had swordfish. It's been a while.
Steak of the sea.
Mm, is that so?
Mm-hmm.
Chicken of the steak?
Mm-hmm.
Can they do chicken fried steak of the sea?
I think that would be a mistake.
All right. You want to do take two on that one?
Nope. Let's say that we are Finn.
He exists in a world beyond your world.